please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
According to recent reports, hate crimes against Muslim communities across Canada increased by 71% in 2021. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International said, in the early morning of December 12th, an intruder attempted to disrupt the morning prayers by attacking the imam at the Islamic Foundation of Torino. A person walked in with his shoes inside the prayer area while the imam was leading the prayer at the mosque located in the city's east end. The intruder jumped over the congregants to reach the imam and not only shouted obscenities at him, but also pulled his beard several times. Two members of the congregation grabbed the assailant and held him until the police arrived. After preliminary investigation, the police took the assailant away, but said no charges would be laid. He was allowed to drive away in his own car. While it is fortunate that nobody was hurt, the imam was clearly shaken. According to eyewitnesses, the imam was shivering after the attack. No charges have been laid and the attacker was not taken into custody, police media officer Shannon Eames told CBC News. Police do not consider it a hate-motivated crime and the individual left the scene after it happened, Eames added. In a statement, the mosque said, "Our hearts are deeply troubled, and we know that many in our community are deeply concerned. We simply do not have enough information to assess what led to this incident." The statement went on, calling on police to keep all avenues of investigation open, including potential hate motivation. Some reports have suggested that the assailant is mentally disturbed. It has become common to declare any assailant who attacks Muslims or their places of worship as mentally deranged. If a Muslim is involved in such activity, he is not only immediately branded a terrorist, but the entire Muslim community is vilified. The recent attack on the Islamic Foundation is the latest in a string of attacks on mosques across Canada. In September 2020, 58-year-old Muhammad Aslam Zafis was stopped and killed outside a mosque in Rexdale. Zafis was a volunteer caretaker who was checking to ensure congregants wore a mask before entering the prayer facility. His assailant, Gullihelm van Nutkem, 34, attacked Zafis and slit his throat with a knife. On January 29, 2017, six members of the Quebec City Mosque were murdered in cold blood and another 19 injured. The assailant, 28-year-old Alexander Bissonnette, entered the mosque while the Muslims were offering night prayers. He was armed with a semi-automatic assault rifle as well as a pistol. Mercifully, the children were playing downstairs in the basement, otherwise many of them, too, would have fallen victim to the terrorist anti-Muslim rage. An equally horrific attack occurred in London, Ontario, on June 6, 2021. Three generations of Afzal family were crushed to death by Nathaniel Veltman, who drove his van over them repeatedly. While the latest attack on the Islamic Foundation of Toronto mercifully did not result in any injuries, it would be wrong to assume that such attacks won't occur in the future. Unfortunately, it is open season on Muslims in Canada. Middle East Eye also had an eye on this issue, writing, Canadian Muslim groups are raising concerns about a recent attack in which an imam was allegedly assaulted during a morning prayer service in Toronto. The Islamic Foundation of Toronto said recently that an intruder had entered the mosque and disrupted the dawn prayer by assaulting the imam before two brave congregants quickly held him back and called 911. In its statement, the mosque condemned the attack and called on the police to keep all avenues of investigation open. Our hearts are deeply troubled, and we know that many in our community are deeply concerned after an incident took place this morning, the official statement read. However, the center said there was not enough information to know what the motivation of the attack was. We understand that this is a difficult and scary time for our community. We must stress, however, that we simply do not have enough information to assess what led to this incident, the Islamic Center said. Toronto police are investigating the matter and have yet to charge the individual. The police said on Twitter that it investigates all potential hate crimes fully and that if charges are laid, it will provide an update to the case. The imam Yusuf Barat released a statement saying that he and many of his congregants remain traumatized, in fear, and very worried after the incident. He said, I pray that no individual or community ever face what horrific incident the IFD congregation and myself have experienced this morning. The National Council of Canadian Muslims and Canada's Council of Imams, CCI, also expressed their concerns over the incident. The CCI's statement said the bravery of the congregants to prevent this ugly incident from escalating is truly remarkable, and CCI strongly encourages all congregants to continue their increased vigilance. Experts in Canada previously told MEE that Canada has witnessed decades of anti-Muslim rhetoric, both from politicians and in the media. Islamophobic and anti-Muslim attacks have also surged in recent years, the most high-profile being the mass shooting at Quebec City Mosque in 2017, where a white Canadian man shot and killed six people. An August report from Statistics Canada found that hate crimes against Muslim communities across the country increased by 71% in 2021. The government study found that the number of recorded attacks against Muslims rose from 84 incidents in 2020 to 144 in 2021. The jump in attacks followed a decline from the previous year, as in 2019, there was a total of 182 reported incidents targeting Muslims. A recent study from October tracked networks peddling Islamophobia throughout Canada over the past 4 years. The 240-page report outlined an ecosystem composed of media outlets, Islamophobia influencers, white nationalist groups, fringe, right-wing pro-Israel groups, security experts, think tanks, and the donors who fund their campaigns. While several reports have outlined the Islamophobia industry in the U.S., this study is the one of the first to deeply look into Islamophobia networks in Canada.
A quarter century after the fall of the Iron Curtain, never have there been so many politically driven walls in our world. Dividing communities, separating the rich from the poor, and marking borders, walls have become the preferred solution for resolving major conflicts. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. This week's documentary explores how the business of constructing barriers is pursued with ever greater physical, financial, and ideological vigor in the 21st century. From the Middle East to the wealthiest societies of the West, municipal, regional, and international walls have become the preferred means of resolving conflicts and addressing or avoiding civil unrest. Stay with us as we investigate the geopolitics of urban and cultural segregation as seen in Iraq, Brazil, and France.
Just imagine that tomorrow we were to live in private villages behind high security fences. The Mirail neighborhood in Toulouse. 35,000 people live here. From the outside, it's considered a volatile ghetto. The Mirail is dogged by high unemployment and boredom. At night, as a distraction, youngsters noisily rev their engines. This is a public area. Only one association is trying to maintain some sort of law and order, a local group called the Mediators.
Don't hang about here, right under the buildings. Go home. Look at the time. People are asleep now.
Okay, we'll go. Actually, until the Mediators tell us to go home, we hang around outside. Do the residents ever call the police to say they can't stand the bloody noise anymore? Yeah, it can happen. It happens often. They call the police, yeah, sure. We know that because they see that the police won't intervene, so they ask us to help. We get involved, but as you saw, they're on public property. And we can talk to them. Tell them to put their motorbikes away. If they listen, all the better. The police never come here for that sort of thing. Well, if they do, it would be a game of cat and mouse, you know what I mean? In this kind of social housing, they now take care of their own security. They've learned to live without the police. That doesn't bother you? No, it's okay. I've never been scared. She's been here since 1975. I mean, sometimes I go out. I come back at 4 or 5 in the morning. Used to come home and I never had any problems. That means there's a... What about the police? Do they ever come here when you call them? The police? I don't know. I really don't know. But I think it would be worse if they did come. Zubir Sadi was born here, grew up here, and has witnessed the neighborhood slowly change. They've only just got their license as well. I've looked after him for a while now. All he did were stupid things. I saw the mix of people who used to live here. There were whites, Europeans, all sorts of backgrounds. I used to see my parents, they'd go and visit the neighbours. All sorts of different mixes of people. But slowly people began to leave. And we were lucky, because we experienced that kind of diversity. These youngsters don't know that. I was scared, to be honest. There was always so much noise. I saw cars set on fire. But unfortunately, the police would never come.
course they'd get attacked. So you felt the estate was left to fend for itself. Yeah, that's right. We'll turn over here. Paulette is one of the middle-class residents that has fled the social housing estates. There, that's it. That last building down there. I used to live there, up on the sixth floor. Do you ever come back?
No.
No. I never wanted to come back. And I never have. Why not? I don't feel comfortable. You see, where I live now, there are just two floors. Here, there can be as many as 15 floors. It's like cages for hens. Paulette moved to a nearby protected estate. There are more of them in Toulouse than anywhere else in France. She now feels much better. We all know each other. We're safe. We can leave the door open. No one can come in. There are no problems. We're not scared of anything. Here we go, this way. Enclosed residences are not necessarily ghettos for the rich. Paulette is a civil servant. That's nice, isn't it? She has a modest salary and a 45 square meter apartment like all those who live here. With her neighbours, Paulette has rediscovered some of the warmth of the poorer areas. I've got just about everybody's spare set of keys because some of my neighbours are a bit scatty, so you never know. It's very friendly here in this residence. I think it's very pleasant to be here. We're not far from town, and it's a bit like being in the countryside. It's quiet, you can walk around, and there's a pool. It's like a holiday camp. But here, the rules are strict. Even too strict, says Christine, a resident. They've been sending out non-stop things, you know, like notices telling people how to behave, not to make too much noise. I think it's... Well, yeah, the rules are a bit strict sometimes. I mean, to ask children not to shout outside. When they need to shout, kids shout. If I hear a kid laughing, I don't think it's a nuisance. That's all. You know, I'm fairly moderate. I don't know. I think it's a bit much. Well, it's not the kids for me, it's the adults. The ones who don't show respect for others, to be honest. There was one person here who wasn't very nice. He made a lot of mistakes. Well, he made noise once or twice. No, he was noisy. I mean, I couldn't sleep once. But my neighbour's camera picked him up. In this small paradise, if you make too much noise, the various security devices will hear you. We're undergoing an urban segregation in this country. Some have recently suggested using the term fragmentation to describe this new kind of town made up of separate parts that have increasingly less in common with each other. So it really marks the end of a kind of society. Yes, it could well be the end of a certain type of society, or in fact a new multi-speed society, a club society, in which the public good is considered like a club. If you can afford it, you pay for membership of the club and benefit from the goods. If you can't, you won't have them. Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, where the economy is booming. The country, though, is cut into two. The middle classes have flocked into enclosed areas, condominiums, entire sectors behind high railings and armed guards. Brazil is copying Florida with its gated communities, enclosed villages. Right next to the condominiums are the world's largest slums. Two nations, that of the rich and the poor, who live on either side of the ramparts. Thais and her mother always lived in the so-called condominios. Well, the idea for condominios came from keeping people closed off, but with hobbies and things to do on the inside. There's a bar where you can meet your friends. It's also to be close to each other without needing to go out or risk being attacked. Why? Because the streets are considered dangerous? Yes, yeah, especially at night. And you can't be at the mercy of other people in the streets. Unfortunately, that's today's reality. So they found the way to mix safety with hobbies and pastimes. It's like being outside. In fact, a whole generation is growing up inside the condominiums that will never get to know the real Brazil. It's true. I really think we've created gilded cages. We're prisoners of luxury. I really wish my children were as lucky as I was. I grew up in an apartment block, but we used to play out in the streets. I had that freedom. Today, if I go past the same area where I grew up, I see it's no longer possible. Everyone's a bit more enclosed nowadays. Right alongside the condominiums are the favelas. It's the Brazil of the workers and cleaning women, as well as armed teenagers who live off the drugs trade. They form an alternative kind of justice in these forgotten slums. Shaolin has been in charge of the residents' association for a long time. To him, segregation is the worst form of violence. More than the physical wall that separates us, there's the invisible social wall, which is far more hurtful. The superior classes in their buildings, and we, people of no class, in our huts. Right next to each other. The city has to integrate, otherwise there'll be chaos. Directly opposite the huge favela Rocinha on the São Conrado beach are some of the most expensive housing estates in Brazil. They're not just criminals up there. There are some better people up there than they are down here. More honest people. One day, Augusta witnessed a shootout between cocaine traffickers and military police. A scene from a war film. And there was a problem fairly recently between the guys from the Vidigal favela and those from Rocinha. They encountered the military police and there was a fight. They ran off, and in the confusion, they crossed in, went out the other side. That's it. They caused no trouble. They just crossed through. You know, this wall, it's not real security. There are 500,000, 400,000 of them, and just 10,000 of us. If they come down, nothing will stop them. On the other side of the railings, the government decided to seize control of the favelas. November 2010, the army and its armored cars are called in. 4 days of fighting in the north zone eventually forces the traffickers out. Government troops hoist the national colors, a symbol of the victory of one nation over another. Today, Captain Felipe Barreto and his men are on patrol to prevent the gangs from returning. I don't know any city like Rio, with the rich right next to the poor, literally wall to wall. The social impact is very negative. You see down there, where the car is? Before, the police wouldn't have been able to go there. 20 meters away, they'd shoot at you. Just one cop on the corner and they'd open fire. So that was the border? Yeah, that was the border. And what about the other public services? Can they come in? Firemen, postmen, doctors? Well, before, it was only with the permission of the traffickers, so it was a parallel government. Exactly, the media used to call it parallel powers. Are they less now? Oh yeah, many were killed. And they fled as well, right?
Yeah, all were arrested. Others moved to Rosinha. Rosinha is home to countless thousands of poor. Among them, some heavily armed young men. The traffickers tolerated our presence on their territory so long as we never filmed them. And we were given escorts. One longtime member of the drug world does, however, agree to be interviewed. Nowadays, Regis has stopped dealing. He's settled down, has a family and work, and tries to lead a dignified life. Like most dealers, Regis was also an addict. I took a lot of drugs for 10 years. From the ages of 15 to 26, I hit rock bottom. A lot of cocaine, alcohol. Oh, it lasted for 10 years. I lost my friends, traffickers, thieves. I used to live among all of that. They call me the last of the Mohicans. Why? Because the rest of my generation are all dead. For many of the favela's youngsters, drugs remains the easiest career move. With the intoxicating feeling the street belongs to you. They are arrogant and well-armed, but few will live to see 30. They will be killed by the police or rival gangs. People used to look at me differently. They'd look away when they saw me. My own mother didn't trust me anymore. But thanks to God, I was able to get out of it. Now I have my daughter, my wife, my house and my work. It must be a struggle. Yeah, it is a struggle. But the most important thing is to have abandoned the drug scene. The favelas issue is about successive governments having basically abandoned them. It's just government negligence. That's why we're in the state we're in today. After having assaulted the area, the police tries to do some social work. A community police unit has set up in the middle of the favela, its aim to stop the drug gangs returning. We arrive, we set up, and then we determine what the needs are, and we try and get back into the areas that have been abandoned by the state. Yeah, by the state and by society in general. Captain Barreto's men have established an advance base at the top of the favela. It's a strategic position with a bird's eye view over the condominiums. And Baghdad, the city of 1,000 walls. After 8 years of war, a fragile peace exists behind these concrete ramparts. The walls crisscross the city over hundreds of kilometers, causing never-ending detours. Abu Hazem is a taxi driver in the Daura district, which was controlled by insurgents back in 2007. I have to go around the wall, go to the end of the motorway, and come all the way back. It's like a huge prison. It's bad for morale, too. Does the wall make it safer? Does it bring work? In fact, the wall has made it safer. Before, no one could pass here. It was too dangerous. Between 2003 and 2007, Iraq was ravaged by an incredibly vicious civil war. U.S. soldiers were constantly targeted. Certain areas were completely controlled by the insurgents. The Shiite and Sunni militias began killing each other. According to The Lancet, a respected medical journal, 600,000 civilians were killed. That's when the Americans conceived of the idea of building walls around the most violent areas. They would contain the insurrection and separate the Sunnis from the Shiites. Baghdad would resemble Berlin during the time of the wall. The U.S. Army spokesman, however, confirms they are also building gated housing,
like the retired people's homes in California.
We're building different walls all throughout the city here, different communities, and you've heard the concept of gated communities.
Mm-hmm. Funny, a gated community, to me, just connotes, you know, an exclusive sort of Coral Gables, Florida kind of setup, which is not what you mean, is it?
The gated communities are designed to protect the population in selected neighborhoods throughout Baghdad.
Many of them don't like it at all. They feel that it will further divide the city on sectarian lines.
Well, the intent is not to divide the city on sectarian lines. Once again, the intent is to provide a more secure neighborhood for the people that live in selected neighborhoods. And if we find areas that we think that the gated communities will do good and will control the population, we'll probably build more.
Each zone is surrounded by a wall. It's like living on a reserve. We're stuck inside. The wall was the Americans' idea. It was American material and vehicles that were used to build it. There never was the split between Sunnis and Shiites before the Americans arrived. Sunnis, Shiites, Christians and Jews, we were all Iraqis first. And the first thing the Americans ask you now is, are you Shiite or Sunni?
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
While the U.S. beats on drums of human rights violations in other countries, it has less care about the situation of women and mothers in the U.S. A new study has revealed that during pandemic, mothers in the U.S. were especially likely to report high levels of stress during the public health crisis if they experienced major disruptions to their daily lives at work, their children's schools, or in their interactions with their communities. Due to a variety of factors, researchers said mothers may be particularly susceptible to psychological stress effects from the COVID-19 pandemic. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Common Dreams wrote in this regard, a study by the National Institute of Health in the first 16 months of the coronavirus pandemic found that mothers in the U.S. were especially likely to report high levels of stress during the public health crisis if they experienced major disruptions to their daily lives at work, their children's schools, or in their interactions with their communities, as the majority of people surveyed said they did. The NIH Environmental Influences on Child Health Outcomes, ECHO program, surveyed more than 11,000 mothers between April 2020 and August 2021, the largest study to date regarding how mothers experienced the pandemic. More than 8,400 respondents reported that their lives had changed dramatically after the World Health Organization declared the worldwide coronavirus outbreak, a pandemic in mid-March 2020, and schools and businesses across the U.S. and the planet were forced to close, furlough or lay off workers, and shift to remote-only models, along with other sweeping changes to daily life. According to lead study author Theresa Bastain, associate professor of clinical population and public health sciences at the Keck School of Medicine of University of Southern California, researchers chose to examine the effects of the pandemic on the mental health of mothers because previous research has described how they took on much of the burden caused by the pandemic-linked changes to the economy and education system. Mothers suffered a large share of the income and job losses and shouldered much of the responsibility of childcare and homeschooling children, the school said in a press release. For example, Pew Research reported in October that for mothers whose youngest child was between the ages of 5 and 12, the average time they spent on secondary childcare, supervising children while doing other activities such as working, increased by about 2.5 hours between 2019 and 2020, going from 5.8 hours per day to 8.2 hours. For fathers, this type of childcare increased by 1.2 hours between 2019 and 2020. In September 2020, Pew also reported that mothers were more than three times as likely as fathers to have lost their jobs in the first months of the pandemic. Mothers may be particularly susceptible to psychological stress effects from COVID-19 pandemic, reads the new study, which was published recently in JAMA Network Open. School closures impact working mothers, leading to loss of income and complementary meals in school settings. Unexpected child care expenses and gaps in adequate technology and quiet space for remote learning. The study continues, it is critical to understand the associations between pandemic hardships and mental health of U.S. mothers. The researchers questioned mothers about how much their daily lives changed as a result of the pandemic, particularly about whether they began working remotely, became more isolated due to social distancing guidelines, had less access to healthcare, or got less physical exercise. They also asked respondents if they had shown signs of acute stress disorder, defined as symptoms that arise after or during an event that threatens one's life or the life of a person's loved ones, including anxiety, negative moods, disassociation, avoidance, and sleepiness. Mothers who reported high levels of pandemic-related disruptions were more likely to report such symptoms, according to the study. It really came down to change, and those mothers whose lives carried on much as they normally had did not report as much stress, said Bastian, adding it was the mothers who had big disruptions who reported the higher levels of stress. Although low-income people and communities of color bore the brunt of the pandemic in numerous ways, with studies showing that Black Americans were more likely to be hospitalized for COVID-19 infections and that socioeconomic factors were linked to the increased odds that Black and Hispanic people test positive for the disease, the study published recently showed that mothers with incomes that were higher than $30,000 were more likely to show signs of stress. The high change cluster contained 8,412 mothers and was characterized by higher incomes, higher education, and higher cohabitation. The high change cluster was more likely to report financial concerns as a source of stress. 3,008 participants, about 35.76% versus 925 participants, about 30.22%, and had a higher proportion of white mothers. 5,539 participants, 65.85% versus 1,656 participants, 54.10%. Both clusters had similar distributions of Latina and Hispanic participants. Lower income people who were surveyed were more likely to have jobs in which they did not have the ability to work remotely, noted the researchers, putting them at greater risk for infection. However, along with the privilege of working remotely and being able to quarantine away from other household members, considerable disruption in day-to-day life was also experienced in the high change cluster, including greater social isolation from family, friends, and colleagues, who are important sources of social support when confronted with a major traumatic life event, reads the study, adding, a surprisingly result was that mothers in the low change cluster reported high post-traumatic stress when they spent more time with family. Spending greater time with family might be stressful for mothers with lower socioeconomic advantage, the study continues, especially if they reside in smaller homes where they may be unable to quarantine away from family members. For mothers across socioeconomic and racial groups, the study shows that we need to think about traumatic experiences like natural disasters, pandemics, or mass shootings more historically. There is a wide range of hardships that women experience from these events that we need to understand, the expert said, adding, so we can protect people from long-term effects.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women as human beings are completely equal in Islam. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyah on January 4th, 2023. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, praise be to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and blessings be upon our Master, Prophet Muhammad, and upon his pure progeny, particularly the remnants of gods on earth. Today's meeting has been very pleasant and useful. God willing, it will have abundant benefits for our future and our way of thinking. I'm very happy that we were able to hold this meeting this year. Last year, some women wrote a letter in the objection stating, why have you dedicated Women's Day to meeting with elegists? They were right. Their objection was correct. Now, such a meeting does not necessarily have to be held on Women's Day. It is fine to hold it around the time of the birth anniversary of Lady Fatima al-Zahra. Now, we will continue to hold this meeting in the future as well, provided I am alive.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Up until this moment, this meeting has been exclusively devoted to women and has been overflowing with outstanding, excellent ideas. The talks given by the women here were very good, and I personally truly benefited from them. Of course, confirming what has been said after merely hearing it, read quickly over a microphone one time is not possible. One must reflect and think about these matters. So be sure to give me the notes. The woman who spoke without referring to any notes should write down the things she said too. This way, it will be both more precise, and I will have more time to think and ponder on it too. Also, I can give these notes to those who can study and think about these matters. Some recommendations were made. God willing, a solution will be found for these matters. Some of these suggestions may be related to the Supreme Council of the Cultural Revolution. These matters, they need to be discussed there or in other places, especially the issue of employing our intelligent, skilled, experienced, knowledgeable, scholarly, wise, perceptive women in different places in the country where decisions are made. This is an important matter.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
In the United States, federal prosecutors are reviewing classified documents found at the Penn Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement in Washington, an office belonging to President Joe Biden. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. CNBC has covered this story and tells us more. A small number of government documents marked as classified were found this fall by lawyers for President Joe Biden in a locked closet in Washington, D.C., a think tank office used by Joe Biden when he was a private citizen, his lawyers confirmed on Monday, 9th of January. The Department of Justice and the National Archives and Records Administration are reviewing the circumstances surrounding the documents, according to a statement by Richard Sober, a special counsel to President Biden. Richard Sober said the documents appear to be from the Obama administration, during which Joe Biden served as vice president. The documents, Richard Sober said, were found at the Penn Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement on 2nd of November 2022. That was nearly 3 months after FBI agents raided the Florida residence of former President Donald Trump and seized more than 100 classified government documents and hundreds of more records that federal prosecutors say belong to the U.S. government. Donald Trump is the focus of a criminal probe by the Department of Justice for his removal of the records from the White House in January of 2021. By law, government records must be given to the National Archives when a president or officials in their administration leave office. Richard Sober's statement was issued after CBS News first reported the discovery of the records at the Penn Biden Center. A source familiar with the situation told NBC News that Attorney General Merrick Garland asked the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Illinois, John Lausch, to review how classified materials ended up at the Penn Biden Center in Washington. That task was intentionally assigned to John Lausch, who was appointed to the prosecutor's office by Donald Trump to avoid any potential conflict of interest, the source told NBC. On Monday night, Donald Trump wrote in a post on his social media site, "When is the FBI going to raid the many homes of Joe Biden, perhaps even the White House? These documents were definitely not declassified," Trump wrote. Donald Trump has claimed without evidence that he declassified records found at his Mar-a-Lago club in Palm Beach, Florida. Even if Trump had declassified the records that had classified markings, he still could face criminal prosecution if the Department of Justice finds he likely broke the law by removing all the records from the White House and by obstructing efforts to recover them. President Biden, during an appearance on the CBS News show 60 Minutes in September, had expressed dismay at an FBI photograph that showed some of the government records found at Mar-a-Lago. "How that could possibly happen? How anyone could be that irresponsible?" Joe Biden asked. "Totally irresponsible." Richard Sober's statement about the Biden documents on Monday, 9th of January, which was provided by the White House, said, "The documents were discovered when the president's personal attorneys were packing files housed in a locked closet to prepare to vacate office space at the center." CBS News has also covered the same story and tells us more. Attorney General Merrick Garland has assigned a U.S. attorney in Chicago to review documents marked classified that were found at the Penn Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement in Washington, two sources with knowledge of the inquiry told CBS News. The roughly 10 documents are from President Biden's vice presidential office at the center, the source said. CBS News has learned the FBI is also involved in the U.S. attorney's inquiry. The material was identified by personal attorneys for President Biden on 2nd of November last year, just before the midterm elections. Richard Sober, a special counsel to the president, confirmed. The documents were discovered when President Biden's personal attorneys were packing files housed in a locked closet to prepare to vacate office space at the Penn Biden Center in Washington, D.C., Richard Sober said in a statement to CBS News. The documents were contained in a folder that was in a box with other unclassified papers, the sources confirmed. the sources revealed neither what the documents contain nor their level of classification. A source familiar with the matter told CBS News the documents did not contain nuclear secrets. Richard Sober also said that on the same day the material was discovered, on 2nd of November 2022, the White House Counsel's office notified the National Archives, which took possession of the materials the following morning. The discovery of these documents was made by the president's attorneys, Richard Sober said. The documents were not the subject of any previous request or inquiry by the National Archives. Since that discovery, the president's personal attorneys have cooperated with the archives and the Department of Justice in a process to ensure that any Obama-Biden administration records are appropriately in the possession of the National Archives.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
One more Palestinian was shot dead early Thursday by Israeli soldiers, this time during a raid in Qalandia refugee camp north of Al-Quds. 41-year-old Samir Aslan was killed only minutes after his 17-year-old son Ramzi was arrested by the Israeli soldiers from their home. Aslan, with other family members, went to the roof of their home to watch what was going on, but a sniper shot him in the chest and soldiers prevented his family members to transfer him to hospital until he died.
A large number of Israeli forces stormed Qalandia refugee camp and detained some 20 Palestinians. Then they headed to the home of the martyr to arrest his son Ramzi. The whole family went up to the roof to see what was happening when they heard loud screams, when an Israeli sniper opened fire and shot Samir directly in the chest.
After Samir was shot, his sons carried him down to transfer him to hospital, but the Israeli soldiers dragged him and put him on the ground and prevented anyone to rescue him. They left only after they made sure Samir succumbed to his injuries. This is a field execution.
Samir Aslan is the third Palestinian killed in the occupied West Bank in the last 24 hours. Israeli forces killed 18-year-old Sanat Samamri following an alleged stabbing attack in the southern occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil. On Wednesday, 21-year-old Ahmed Junaid was shot dead in the head during a military raid on the Balata refugee camp in Nablus, north of the occupied West Bank.
The continuation of these raids and campaigns means that this current Israeli cabinet will continue the aggressive policies against the Palestinians in a bid to fight resistance and prevent any form of activity in the occupied West Bank.
Tensions have been running high in the occupied Palestinian territories since last year. Nearly 180 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank alone in 2022. The United Nations said death toll was the highest since 2006 in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military's brutality shows no sign of abating and is cracking down on Palestinian fighters as well as the general population here. Palestinians warn of even more aggressive policies by Israel's current right-wing regime led by Benjamin Netanyahu. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The National Women's Day in Iran does not coincide with the international occasion.